This is Functional Medicine Update for October 2010, Volume 30, Number 10. In this issue, we'll explore the functional medicine approach to cancer. Topics we'll cover this month include cancer as a chronic disease, insulin signals and oncogenic risk, tracking the tendrils in the web of bioenvironment. We'll be finding the zone of optimal function, looking at insulin signaling and hemoglobin A1C, high sensitivity CRP, and genomic instability. In this month's interview, we'll talk to Dr. Jeannie Wallace, discussing the functional medicine approach to cancer. Now, here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the October 2010 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
This month we're going to deal with a topic that I know has been discussed at length over the last several years in various forums on Functional Medicine Update, but we're going to take a slightly different spin, a different look, a different perspective, a different part of the matrix or the lens upon which we focus information to ultimately arrive at clinical decision making. And the focus this time will be taking the concept of metastatic disorders, proliferative cellular disorders, and sieving it through a slightly different way of looking at the origin and the management and the progression of cancer. And of course, this plays out of the fantastic symposium, the Institute for Functional Medicine symposium entitled Cancer as a Chronic Disease, held in May of 2010. And that particular symposium really dealt with this whole new context of cancer as a chronic disease. Why would we say it's a chronic disease? Well, fortunately, as a consequence of a number of the major breakthroughs in therapeutic tools that are available for the treatment of cancer, many people who would have previously not survived from the initial diagnosis are now in either remission or in states of chronic management. In fact, over 300,000 people in the United States alone are now managing cancer as kind of a chronic process. What that means is that the disease, which had a previous reputation of being a lethal disease, one that leads always to a terminal event, now is a condition that in many cases may be managed more as a chronic disease. That raises the question then, what is the origin of cancer? Why would it undergo this transition from a disease with a certain reputation of pathophysiology leading to mortality to that which can be managed? And what does that mean about the future as it relates to the management of this condition and maybe its prevention? It's those kinds of questions that really were the focus of the 17th Annual Symposium of the Institute for Functional Medicine. And it's those types of things that I would like to focus in a little bit more with some deeper drilling in this issue of Functional Medicine Update. We're going to be very privileged to have our clinician of the month this month, Dr. Jeannie Wallace, who is one of the most highly rated presenters at the 17th International Symposium on Cancer as a Chronic Disease. Dr. Wallace will be talking about her vast experience in consultation and patient management in the area of cancer later, but I thought I might set the context for her discussion with you just to raise some different perspectives about how we're thinking of this disorder. So let's first talk a little bit about the nature of what signals a cell that's a fully differentiated cell, a eukaryotic human cell sitting somewhere in the body, to go from that state of developmental biology where it is in a static state to undergo this transformation into a de-differentiated state that is cell proliferative in nature, that is invasive, and ultimately has a metastatic potential and also is angiogenic, where it's starting to send out little new blood vessels to nourish the mass as it grows. What would be the process that would trigger that? Historically, we've talked about the role that carcinogens or mutagens play in mutating or altering genomic messages, causing nicks or damage and chromosomal instability that ultimately produces mistakes and causing upregulation of expression factors of this dedifferentiated primordial state of the cell that we call a cancer cell. for much of our past 30 years, this concept of a carcinogen-induced cancer has dominated the field in thinking. And of course, you even talk about in situ carcinogens, like, for instance, estrogens and estrogen byproducts that may be in situ carcinogens as a consequence of their influence on DNA. We are very familiar and have interviewed twice on Functional Medicine Update Dr. Eleanor Rogan from the University of Nebraska. And you recall she is a Linus Pauling Award winner from the Institute for Functional Medicine for her pioneering work that she's done on the oxidative metabolism of estrogens into the hydroxyestrogens and finally into the quinones. These quinone-like estrogens, the 3-4 quinones, which then can react very rapidly with electrophilic regions of the genome DNA to produce these mutational adducts, which then intercalate in such a way as to cause potential misreading of the genomic message and start neoplasm. So Dr. Rogan has been at the forefront of understanding how an endogenous hormone, estrogen, undergoing specific types of metabolic transformations, in this case to 4-hydroxyestrogens, which then can become oxidized into these 3-4 quinones, could initiate a cancer. And therefore it begs the question, how do you prevent then the formation of these endogenous carcinogens? And that leads us into the discussion of things like detoxification. How does estrogen get detoxified and ultimately eliminated as a glucuronide or as a sulfate in a non-toxic form that can be excreted either in the feces or in the urine? And Dr. Rogan has pointed out that these particular metabolic transformations of estrogens are facilitated by a group of cytochrome P450s, one of which is cytochrome P450-1B1, one of the isoforms of the more than 100 different members of this family of cytochrome P450 enzymes. And that cytochrome P450-1B1 not only resides in the liver in its activity, but also it resides in the breast. It can be activated in breast tissue to increase the production of these 3-4 quinones, estrogen quinones. And so then it begs the question, well, what do you do to prevent the activity of cytochrome P450-1B1? One thing to do is to increase the conversion of estrone and estradiol into agents that would not be allowed to go to become 3-4 estrogen quinones, and that's by the 2-hydroxylation pathway to form the 2-hydroxy estradiol and estrone. The hydroxylation by cytochrome P450-1E2 and 1A2 produces these other estrogen metabolites, which then prevent the conversion by 1B1 into the carcinogenic 3-4 estrogen quinones. And we know that the cruciferous vegetables that contain the class of phytochemicals called glucosinolates, things like indole-3-carbinol and 3-hydroxy-2-butene and phenylisothiocyanate and even including sulfurophane, that these activate gene expression in the liver and other tissues of the enzymes that are responsible for the formation of the 2-hydroxyestrogens. So that's the dietary epidemiology that says that women who consume more crucifers have statistically a lower incidence of female hormone-related cancers. And so one even sees intervention trials where women were given placebos or given supplemental doses of these phytochemicals, particularly I3C or diindolylmethane, DIM, which is a polymeric conjugate of I3C, and have demonstrated that it increases the excretion of the 2-hydroxyestrogens. In the case of I3C, there's actually a clinical trial showing after supplementation over a period of a matter of weeks, there is a reversion of the cellular architecture back to normal, suggesting that this has a very favorable effect in lowered estrogen drive or these estrogen metabolites on DNA injury. So we are starting to witness this kind of connection between epidemiology to, I guess you'd call it, cellular mechanisms of action and how this all relates to environmental factors such as diet that may induce or prevent specific cancers. We also recognize that cytochrome P450-1B1 is activated by the appearance of certain types of the conjugated equine estrogen B-ring unsaturated estrogens. These are the things that are found in pregnant mare's urine, these unnatural estrogen molecules that are found in mares, but they're not found in women. And that these B-ring unsaturated estrogens that are found in equine estrogen hormones activate cytochrome P450-1B1 and therefore have a more preferential metabolism into these 3-4 estrogen quinones, which we've said are more carcinogenic. So there are probably a variety of different routes of contribution to changing the balance of metabolism of estrogen. Dioxin is another one that's known to enhance the activity of cytochrome P450-1B1 and may increase then the burden of these carcinogenic estrogens. So as we learn more about the story, we learn more of both what things to avoid and what things to expose the woman to improve the hormonal balance. This is very similar to what Dr. Sidney Baker has said so many times when asked, what's the difference between a functional medicine approach towards the patient and a traditional diagnostic pathophysiological approach? And his answer, his soundbite, which is brilliant, is the functional medicine approach is to ask two questions. What is the patient getting too much of, and what is the patient not getting enough of? And to remove those substances that the patient is getting exposed to in excess and to add back those things that the patient is not getting enough of. This is kind of personalized medicine based on a very simple conceptual framework that has the patient being asked different kinds of questions in their narrative about how their history got them to where they are. So this whole concept of antecedents then leading to ultimately triggers producing a mediation of various signaling substances that ultimately work on target tissues to produce signs and symptoms, that's a different model than the drive for the name of the pathophysiology and putting a diagnosis on that condition. It's more asking how you got there rather than what is it that you finally got to. So this conceptual framework of cancer may derive in part out of this endogenous and exogenous exposure to carcinogens, as I've just described with the estrogen story. But it goes beyond that, and I think this next step is where the world gets more both interesting and probably more confusing. And I owe Dr. Barry Boyd, a medical oncologist, an integrative oncologist from Connecticut who is associated with the Yale University Medical School program, for starting me down this path of thinking in terms of oncology and oncogenic burden from this perspective. A number of years ago, Dr. Boyd was asked to speak at the Institute for Functional Medicine Symposium, and during that talk, he alluded to the fact that insulin signaling played a very important role in the potential oncogenic risk that a patient might have, and also to the progression of tumors. At that point in time, I hadn't really thought much about insulin as being a hormone that had anything to do principally with tumorigenesis or oncogenesis. Since that time, however, thanks to Dr. Boyd, I've come to recognize that this is a very, very active area of research, one that has enormous potential clinical implications, and one that is, fortunately, something you can intervene against, because both you can measure insulin signaling and you can manage insulin signaling. So it's not just an esoteric concept that we say, oh, there's a risk factor, but there's nothing we can do about it. In this case, we would say, hey, there is a risk factor, once we understand it, that we can do something about it, and we can intervene with the appropriate diet and lifestyle and, if necessary, pharmacology program. So what's this all about? What this is about is the recognition that insulin is much more than just a glucose-modulating hormone. And I think we have all started to recognize in this field the pleiotropic effects that insulin has, the multiple personalities that it has, as it regulates a complex set of genes in their expression. It does so by binding to the insulin binding site, the insulin receptor, and then triggering through a very complex signaling mechanism through insulin receptor substrate 1 and down through a variety of interrelated kinase signaling molecules, including Burton tyrosine kinase, or BTK, and spleen tyrosine kinase, SYK, and ultimately down through phosphatidyl inositol 3 kinase and through mTOR and down through glycogen synthase kinase 3. And this is, I know, sounding very esoteric and biochemical-ish, so let me kind of just summarize what I've just said by saying that there is this complex pachinko game, if you know the Japanese pinball game, where you hit a little ball up to the top and then you are able to create from that a multiple series of hits of these balls as they move down from the top to the bottom, and ultimately you rack up a score, right? So one ball can create multiple actions if you are lucky and you play the game right. Well, that's very similar to the way kinases work. We learn in school about biochemistry from these charts as linear paths, and we call them metabolic pathways. But really, these metabolic pathways are just like really tendrils in a web of a network of physiology. And so we kind of freeze frame one tendril, which looks linear. Substrate goes to product, and we memorize that, like glucose going to glucose-6-phosphate. But yet that is embedded within this very complex web of interacting pathways that forms this network. The network of signaling substances within a cell that translates the outside world to the inside function that ultimately regulates things like mitochondrial function, endoplasmic reticular stress, oxidative phosphorylation, and genomic expression are a series of more than 300 different enzymes that have names, kinases. And I've spoken to these at length in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. These kinases are phosphorylating enzymes that modulate and modify the function of enzymes in the cell by sticking a phosphate group on something like a serine or a tyrosine residue on the protein chain to slightly modify its structure, which then modifies its function. So they're regulatory. It's like the fine-tuning knob of the body. Now, we start thinking of the fine-tuning knob. These are things that can be modulated, as fine-tuning knobs often do, by the local environment. So the kinase regulation of gene expression is in part controlled by the local environment of the cell, which is controlled by the environment of the host. So times of ischemia, or times of dehydration, or times of hyperthermia, or times of toxic exposure, or times of malnutrition, it modifies the expression of this relay race that we call the kinases, and how that then influences differential expression of the genes. Now, let me take an example of this so it sounds a little bit more reasonable. We've all heard recently about the important role that the phytochemical resveratrol, found in peanut skins and grape skins, has on modulating what are called the sirtuin, silent transduction of genes that are associated with longevity, SIRT1. The regulation of SIRT1, this is NAD-dependent deacetylase family of enzymes that are modulated in their activity by resveratrol. What's been found recently is if you look at various kinds of compounds that are found in nature, it's not just resveratrol that modulates sirtuin-1 in eukaryotic mammalian cells, but also other polyphenols and other phenolic phytochemicals are found to play roles in modulating sirtuin. So it's a symphonic modulation of sirtuin function. If you start looking then at what the roles that these sirtuins have on cell function, what you'll find is that the roles through NAD-dependent deacetylase activity is to alter gene expression of some of these kinases. And the kinases ultimately go on to alter then the phosphorylation patterns of various proteins and enzymes in the cell, which then modifies its function to make it a cell that is more insulin sensitive, a cell that's more energy economical relative to mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation, a cell that has lower proliferative potential, a cell that has more apoptotic potential if it's become a transformed cell, a cell that is less prone to inflammatory signaling. So these multiple effects, I call them pleiotrophic effects, that come out of modulating the sirtuin gene expression is in fact related to the role that certain environmental substances, in this case dietary polyphenols, have on kinase signaling. Now, why is that all such a long-winded, important explanation looping back to the insulin story? Because insulin is a very powerful modulator of principal intracellular signaling kinase processes that are associated with a whole array of cellular phenotypes, cellular outcomes, not just glucose transport alone. That's certainly an important part of this, is getting the energy molecule glucose into cells efficiently. But beyond that, there are many other roles that this alteration by insulin of the signaling pathways have on cellular phenotype. These include things like inflammatory status, cell proliferative status, apoptotic status, the cellular architecture, the cytoskeletal structure, many different things, including even the effects on mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation and bioenergetics. So if you have a dysfunctional insulin signaling regulatory pathway and you're overdriving some of these kinase mediators, what can happen is that you actually change the phenotype of the cell into a personality that can be more prone to be a cell that is transformed, a proliferative cell, a cell that becomes more relatively angiogenic, a cell that ultimately may become metastatic. So this hyperinsulin state associated with insulin resistance has now been found to overdrive specific kinase modulated pathways that then in part increase the relative risk of a metastatic disorder. Now, when I talk kinases and oncogenesis, of course, you know that there are a whole series of new kinase inhibiting drugs that are used in cancer treatment that are billion-dollar blockbuster drugs that are very hard-hitting inhibitors of specific kinases that are associated with growth of cells and proliferative phenotypes. The challenge with some of these drugs, however, is that because they're so hard-hitting and they're so efficient in locking down specific kinases, that you get collateral damage because there are other places where the activity of those kinases may be considered important for housekeeping function of cells, and so you start getting off-target effects, and some fairly severe adverse side effects are potential from these kinase-inhibiting drugs, like Gleevec being a good example of that, one of the, I think it was the first major blockbuster kinase-inhibiting drug for use in cancer and now use in inflammatory diseases as well. This is to be contrasted with the modulation of kinases more mildly or moderately through insulin signaling and ultimately through the dietary regulation, things like polyphenols or other phytochemicals that may regulate kinase signaling. So when we talk about a diet that's really good for cancer, it's very interesting that many of these diets, be it the Kushi diet program or the Ornish diet program or the minimally processed high fruit and vegetable type diet program, all of these share characteristics in common of having a low glycemic load, meaning low insulin stimulating, and having a high phytochemical concentration in terms of modulating with these phytochemical specific kinase signaling processes. So there's undoubtedly something very profoundly important buried in this emerging science that's starting to come to light that correlates the profound influence that a low glycemic load diet has in combination with a phytochemically dense diet in regulating the cellular intracellular signal communication process. It leads to speaking to the genes and creating an outcome called either quiescent cell or cell division, causing proliferation. So this ties almost back, doesn't it, to our previous discussion of various endogenous hormones that are converted, like the estrogens, into potential mutagenic or carcinogenic substances. We wouldn't call necessarily insulin a carcinogen, but we would call it a modifier of gene expression function that can correlate with proliferative disorders. Now, for those of you that have been following the literature, know that this story has taken a little bit of an interesting twist in 2010, because in 2010, what was found and reported in a number of journals was that diabetics that are insulin-requiring diabetics with specific forms of insulin therapy appear to have a higher statistical prevalence of cancer. And therefore, the question was raised, do certain forms of insulin or certain types of insulin administration actually increase the relative risk to cancer by an overdrive of these signaling pathways? And there is quite a debate going on now within the field as to whether this relative risk is highly significant or moderately significant or insignificant. But I do think that the data is quite clear that certain types of insulin administration in diabetics do appear statistically to be associated with increased incidence of cancers. So insulin in and of itself, again, you know, some people want to put labels on molecules and say, well, it's a bad molecule or a good molecule. Like I've heard so many times the name arachidonic acid being considered a bad molecule as a fatty acid metabolite. But yet, if you didn't have any arachidonic acid in your cells, you would have a very dysfunctional immune system protection that would put a person into an immune compromised state. So you need adequate levels of arachidonic acid. So it's not a good molecule or a bad molecule. It's a molecule that has important roles to play when in proper balance. And by the same token, we could say that with insulin, this polypeptide protein molecule, this peptide hormone, it is not a good or bad molecule. It is a functional molecule in the range of concentrations and activities that leads to healthy homeostatic function. Too low, you get pathology, and too high, you get pathology. And this is the classic example of Tolman's law of pharmacology for all substances, is parabolic dose response curve. Everything, including air and water, has a dose too low that leads to death, like by dehydration for water, or hypoxia, anoxia for oxygen. But on the other side, there is a dose that can be considered toxic. For water, hyperhydration can be lethal. Hyperoxygenation can be lethal. So it's really the challenge of the functional medicine practitioner to help the patient to be in their zone of optimal function at the top of the parabola, whatever concentration that is of substances that induces or supports proper function would be the ideal state. So you're getting optimal function versus concentration. Now, because this algorithm I'm just describing of the body, this network is so complex with literally thousands of things going on in each cell in real time, in each cell type being different from every other cell type, the complexity of this seems overwhelming. And that's why we choose certain kinds of biomarkers to assess more of the smoke rather than the fire. We look at the shadows on the wall of the cave. We often can't look at the direct processes going on, so we have to look at the artifacts or the secondary byproducts, and we call these biomarkers. In terms of insulin, the biomarkers we use, because we can't analyze all the insulin signaling pathways in all these cells and know how it's turned on or turned off, we look at things that are related to overall insulin signaling processes. So these may be things like hemoglobin A1C, and we start saying, well, hemoglobin A1C or glycosylated hemoglobin is a surrogate biomarker for the relative effectiveness of insulin. Now, there are many other variables and many other factors that are involved in this, so we're oversimplifying to say it's just a measurement of insulin activity, but it's a kind of a surrogate biomarker for insulin. So then you start saying, well, what is a good level of hemoglobin A1C if we're trying to balance the patient and monitor and manage their insulin signaling? It used to be we would say that hemoglobin A1C or glycosylated hemoglobin was principally useful for following the success of compliance in a diabetic patient and trying to keep their hemoglobin A1C levels below, say, 7.5% of total hemoglobin. And patients with glycosylated hemoglobins of 9% or 11% or higher than that were people that were undergoing this non-enzymatic reaction of glucose with their globin portion of their hemoglobin molecule to glycosylate, and the more glycosylation, the more injury to the hemoglobin, but also the presumption of the more injury to many other proteins by this non-enzymatic glycosylation, and also the suggestion that this is a measurement of the kind of time-lapse photography of glucose physiology in the whole body over the life of the red cell, about 120 days. So we were using this principally in medicine as a way to monitor compliance and the control in a diabetic patient. Over the last decade, however, many more detailed studies have been ongoing looking at glycosylated hemoglobin levels in individuals who have marginal insulin resistance or might be considered metabolic syndrome patients, people with refractory insulin resistance with elevated triglycerides and low to HDLs and increased abdominal circumference. And so in this case, these patients may not yet be diabetic, but what has been found recently is that their hemoglobin A1C start drifting up. So it's not just like there's a threshold above which you're suddenly in trouble and below which you're completely safe. It's more of a gradation, as we've seen often in almost all variables that we measure, that there's a gradation. And this is consistent, isn't it, with the parabolic dose response, because a parabola is a continuous curve. It's not a discontinuous curve. So you go up one side of the parabola, go to the top, and then down the other side. And it's a continuous line. So what does that really mean in terms of following a patient? It means that these serial analyses of biomarkers like glycosylated hemoglobin become very important. That's not just taking one data point and then trying to make a decision. It's rather trying to follow the patient over time and seeing what the relative delta, the rate of change is. Is it going up? Is it going down? Is it staying the same? Going up is not good. Staying the same or going down is considered desirable. So we're using this surrogate biomarker to track the success of therapy and trying to define an environment, let's call it a molecular milieu in the cell, that would reflect proper cellular signaling and proper gene expression patterns. So in the patient who is not a diabetic necessarily, but who has an elevated glycosylated hemoglobin, who is an individual who may have other family histories of cancer, who may have other risk factors, you might then, as part of therapy, direct intentionality towards modulating glycosylated hemoglobin, lowering it as a biomarker for the influence you're having on insulin signaling and its ultimately influence on cell proliferation. So this is an example of a different strategic approach towards that of both susceptibility to cancer and the management of cancer in the kinds of things that we use as a snapshot to track the patient and to engage in personalized intervention. Another, I would call it, adjunctive biomarker that can be used is high sensitivity CRP as a surrogate marker for inflammatory potential. Now that we know from past experience and discussions we've had in Functional Medicine Update that CRP is a relative problematic biomarker for inflammatory assessment because it's a pretty downstream marker, C-reactive protein. You recall that what really happens in this cascade of inflammation is that upstream there is the production of inflammatory cytokines triggered by tumor necrosis factor alpha, which then produces interleukin-6, IL-6. IL-6 then travels systemically and ultimately triggers the liver to induce gene expression of a protein called C-reactive protein. And so C-reactive protein is kind of a second signal messenger of inflammation. It's a second guard. It's not looking at the primary modulator. It's looking at a secondary effect. But even with that limitation, we see that drifting upward with hsCRP levels in serology is reflective of chronic inflammation. Now, I want to put a caveat on that, saying that hsCRP is very susceptible to outside, quote, noise in that test. Such things as if a person has the cold or the flu will elevate temporarily hsCRP. If they have an injury, like a musculoskeletal injury, it will be reflective in an elevated hsCRP. If they have a chronic state of some type of a trauma, that can elevate hsCRP. So I think we have to be aware of the fact there can be these spikes in hsCRP that are temporal, and the patient levels will come back down once they've gotten over that immediate insult. But for a patient that has, on a regular basis with no underlying infection or trauma, an increasing level of hsCRP in their blood that's above 1 mg/dL, what would be seen as kind of a baseline level, something below less than 1, that particular value as it drifts up is a very good surrogate biomarker for inflammatory burden. So the combination of using the glycosylated hemoglobin test with the hsCRP test starts to develop an understanding of a landscape, right, related to potential risk to various kinds of chronic conditions, one of which, and we're speaking here specifically, is that of cancer, a proliferative disorder. So what I'm really trying to get you to understand is that as we look at this cancer as a chronic disease question, we're led into a different lens of assessing information and throwing the net a little broader for collecting information, not just looking at tumor markers, which are the traditional way that you follow a diagnosis of a cancer, but really looking at the molecular milieu, looking at the intracellular environment to try to appreciate what is going on at the gene expression level that might in fact encourage these metastatic problems. The last one that probably should be put on the list, and this list could be fairly long, but one last big pillar that I'd like to add is that of genomic instability. We know that oxidative stress induces genomic instability by inducing genomic damage, both at the mitochondrial DNA level and at the nuclear DNA level. Measurements of oxidative stress, like TBA active materials, that's called T-bars, are looking at 8-oxoprostin levels or looking at 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine levels in the blood. These are surrogate markers for oxidative injury to various biomolecules, including fatty acids or DNA, that reflect then the potential for oxidative stress. And this is another correlation with genomic instability, genomic damage, and ultimately to the potential oncogenic potential of that cell. So if you were to couple together these tests, like that of hemoglobin A1C, hsCRP, and other inflammatory biomarkers, and that of the oxidative stress markers, you're starting to observe a landscape that is associated with the potential that we call oncogenic potential. And I think it's that type of model that you're going to hear much more from Dr. Wallace as it relates to how she counsels physicians and patients who have malignancy in trying to develop the proper physiological environment so that it's less selective for cells that are transformed having a friendly opportunity for proliferation, angiogenesis, and metastasis. This is a very, very different model, I think, than the traditional diagnosis and treatment model in oncology. It's not in place of. That model can still be consistent to a traditional treatment model, but I think what we're looking at is a functional approach towards oncological burden that is hopefully going to be adjunctive and amplify the successive positive outcome in a patient who has early stage malignancy or is being treated for cancer or is managing malignancy as a chronic disease. It gives some new tools, some new rules of the road upon which one can navigate. Now you might say, what's new about this? And I think what's new about all this is that this is assembling some of the more recent, and when I say recent, within the last decade, understanding of the cellular and molecular physiology of cancer, the whole cancer biology, and trying to take that cancer biology understanding and apply it clinically, knowing that we're still in a house that's under construction, that we don't have all the architecture worked out. It's a very complex network, as we've described, for which much of it is still a mystery. But that doesn't mean we can't act. That doesn't mean the information that we have at hand won't provide valuable approaches that will augment and improve successful outcome. So with that in mind, I hope I've laid a context now for what we're going to be hearing from the expert, the highly ranked presenter at the 17th International Symposium on Functional Medicine under Cancer as a Chronic Disease, Dr. Jeannie Wallace. Well, I know you've heard this said by me many times, and that is, this is the part of Functional Medicine Update U, and I both look forward to, you know, I wrap around our clinician or researcher of the month each month a little narrative that hopefully explicates and supports and enriches what they have to say, but the voice that they bring to this issue is really the premier reason for being, the raison d'etre for Functional Medicine Update, and we're very, once again, privileged to have an extraordinary presenter, clinician, who's going to talk to us about this very intimate and complicated but very important area that was the focus of our 17th International Symposium for Functional Medicine in May of 2010, which was on cancer as a chronic disease, which in and of itself may sound like an oxymoron, how one could consider cancer as a chronic disease. But as we start to learn more about the etiology of cancers and we learn more about how to put together a comprehensive care program, and as patients now start to survive through the primary therapy into years of life after, then the question really relates to what's the best management, how to manage it on the front end, during and after. All these questions of compassionate care become very, very important. And this goes beyond just the buzzword of integrated cancer therapy or integrated oncology to really look at the whole milieu, the ecos of this unique condition of cell replicative disorders that we call cancers. And we're very privileged to have Dr. Jeannie Wallace, who at the 17th International Symposium was really the top-ranked speaker out of a very remarkable portfolio of experts in the field that presented over the 4 days of the symposium. Dr. Wallace has pioneered what she terms as a multimodal approach
that targets multiple aspects of cancer pathophysiology. We're going to learn from her own lips a little bit more what that means. But it all relates to this dysregulated cell signaling, gene expression, how that turns into things like angiogenesis and metastatic processes, and how one then goes about leading to selective apoptosis of transformed cells. How do you re-differentiate cells into their normal architecture? And how do you support properly whole organism immune function? So these are all parts of a different strategic thought about cancer as a chronic disease and how one might design a program to manage it. So Dr. Wallace is a certified clinical nutritionist. She's a PhD in her background. In 2001, she submitted a best case series of 101 glioblastoma multiforme stage 4 brain tumor patients to the National Cancer Institute's Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and the data was updated in April of 2004 to include 325 cases that was favorably reviewed. She's a member of the Society of Integrative Oncology and the National Association of Nutritional Professionals, and is just a remarkable, dedicated professional, counselor, guide, and presenter. So with that introduction, Dr. Wallace, welcome to Function Medicine Update. Thanks for being with us, and what was your path that led you to this extraordinarily demanding but also fulfilling occupation?
Well, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the introduction. It's nice to be here. I often describe my path here as having been drafted because I didn't volunteer to work in the field of cancer. I grew up with a large family history of cancer and watched grandparents and my uncles pass away. My mother and my sister are both survivors. So I knew as a fairly young person that I wanted to work with cancer patients. I started out doing that in psychology in my training and didn't feel right there and looked at some other ways of going. And it was when a friend of mine developed a stage 4 brain tumor that I decided I was working in the field of nutrition, and we couldn't find anyone to help her. And I decided this is it. I've been drafted and this is my calling, and really turned the focus of my practice at that time toward the look at primary brain tumors and nutrition. And I had been working with some other types of cancer for a couple of years. That really became my sole focus at that time. And happily to say, she is still alive. It's 13 years later, and she's a survivor both of primary brain tumor, glioblastoma, as well as advanced breast cancer.
You know, you used a word there that I know we'll come back to discuss in some aspects over the course of our conversation, and that's the word survivor. It's always struck me that that word is kind of passive. It's used quite a bit in this field for people who successfully go through the process and come out the other side successfully. But in my experience, survivor sounds almost weak because it sounds as if the person was lucky to survive versus what often happens, which is a very aggressive victory. I've almost wanted to change the common language now to say, rather than survivor, that these are champions or victors or something of that nature. What's been your experience with how patients go to the other side relative to their whole outlook and emotion and approach towards their disease?
Well, I have to agree with you, and certainly the way the field is sort of set up, you know, we have the oncologists with their single-minded focus, not all of them, but a great number of them, have such a single-minded focus on the cancer cell and really view this as a war that they're having difficulty winning with the tools that we have, the weapons of radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery, and the idea of the patient just sort of coming and submitting passively to the treatment. This is not at all the experience I have in working with my clients. These are individuals who see their role very much as a team, and that the work that they do with nutrition, with mind-body medicine, with their attitude, with guided visualization and other complementary therapies, they're very aggressively pursuing this. And I agree, the champion or victor is a much better name for how they would see themselves.
So tell us a little bit, maybe you can use an example of how a patient would, as a client, come to you and how you might see them and walk through the relationship with them with their disease.
Yeah, I'm lucky in that the great majority of my clients come because they're referred by oncologists, and this certainly wasn't true 10 years ago, but when I work with a client, I have put together for them a very lengthy report and some materials that sort of guide them through an understanding of this, what I call the oncometabolic milieu, this sort of understanding of the underlying processes in their body and a focus on the terrain of the environment in their body that is promoting or fostering the progression of the cancer. So I really want to put power or empower those clients so that they understand that there is much that they can do to address the cancer in addition to going through the conventional medical treatments that they do. So We're lucky we get referrals from cancer centers all over the country and outside the U.S. as well. Clients come and they often don't have a sense of what we're going to do, and so we do some orientation time and give them a sense. One thing that we like to do is we like to look at the environment in their body with a series of tests. So we have them fill out extensive intake materials about their medical history and their medications and their diet and their social life. We collect as much data as we can. Sometimes we don't use it until later when we get the aha, but we do like to collect a lot of data. And then we run some tests because I want to get a sense of what's going on inside this person's body. I want to come back to that term that I've coined, that oncometabolic milieu. I really have taken that from the idea in cardiovascular disease over the last, say, 10 years, where we've come to understand that metabolic syndrome is this antecedent or precursor of events going on in the body that foster and favor that cardiovascular disease process. I think the same thing can be said in cancer, where we've had such a narrow focus on the cancer cell as if it were an island existing in isolation. And what we really see now is that many events going on in the body, such as systemic inflammation and hypercoagulability and incompetence of the immune system and dysregulation in hormones and also metabolic syndrome, these are factors that favor aggressive cancer growth, metastasis, invasion, angiogenesis, and cancer progression. And so there is much we can do with nutrition and also with many of the other complementary therapies that address this oncometabolic milieu and give the client a way to really be a team member in the care of their cancer. So we run testing, and we, for example, will look at metabolic syndrome. We like to look at the A1C, glycated hemoglobin A1C. We'll run a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, vitamin D levels, sometimes different hormone levels, and we'll look at these to get a sense of where should we put our focus in our counseling with this client. Each cancer patient has a different fingerprint of this syndrome, so that we would have some clients who have elevated inflammation and elevated fibrinogen, but the immune system actually looks fairly okay, and maybe their blood sugar regulation looks fairly okay. And another client, perhaps with the same disease and diagnosis and other similar characteristics, the underlying terrain looks very different for them, where they're not maybe a state of hypercoagulability and inflammation. Instead, they have metabolic syndrome and deficiencies in vitamin D and other nutrients, elevated copper, for example. So we do that testing, and then we sort of individually tailor our consulting for the client based on that testing.
Well, you have, in that very extraordinarily condensed, articulate, rapid delivery, covered a huge landscape of important information. So I'd like to go back and pick up a few of the details, because that was brilliantly stated. The term that you coined, which I really like, oncometabolic milieu, I wrote a couple of articles that appeared this year on using a slightly different term, but I'm amazed as to how convergent our thoughts were.
And I hadn't seen your articles until I was at Functional Medicine. So
yeah,
it was interesting to see our brains were going along the same pathway.
They really were, because I talked oncogenic potential, but I really like your term better. I think it's a more robust term. So let's go through some of the subtypes that you just described, the hypercoagulability, the hormones, the metabolic syndrome, hyperinsulinemic condition, the inflammation, oxidative stress, and relationships to nutritional imbalance. You probably use as a surrogate marker, obviously, fibrinogen to look at coagulability. Tell us a little bit about how does the coagulability component connect to your oncometabolic milieu?
When I was putting this together, and this is really sort of like 10 years of my research coalesced into one theory here, what I have done is survey the literature for different markers that modulating them or reaching a certain threshold can alter the progression of the cancer or alter response to treatment. Now, I have maybe 4 dozen of these different markers, and I've really narrowed it down to 5 or 6 markers because they seem the most robust. When fibrinogen is elevated, a couple of things happen. It increases the metastatic potential of the cancer. This probably happens through several different mechanisms. It may be that the fibrin is sticking to the cancer cells and helping them evade the immune response. It might be that the fibrinogen is enhancing metastasis directly. it might be that it decreases the circulation and the delivery of oxygen to the tumor site, and those hypoxic areas are then resistant to treatment. Or it may be that chemotherapy doesn't perfuse out to the tissue because the blood is sort of thick and sludgy because of the high fibrin. There's sort of multiple mechanisms of action here. So if you look at the literature, there's some different cutoff points. Some studies have suggested that, for example, in lung cancer patients, fibrinogen above 350 is associated with poor survival, poor response to treatment. Some studies have used 310. We use 310 as our cutoff, and so when we measure the fibrinogen, if a client is elevated quite a bit above that, we will advise them on diet and nutritional supplements, botanicals, that lower their fibrinogen, do an intervention, say, for 3 months or 6 months, come back and repeat the test to ensure that what we're doing in terms of dietary and nutritional support is actually effective at altering that particular parameter. Inflammation, and we use a C-reactive protein here, and hypercoagulability go sort of hand in hand. And so oftentimes when the fibrinogen is elevated, you also see high C-reactive protein. And inflammatory, there's such a large body of data and research studies linking systemic inflammation to all types of events in the oncostatic process or oncogenic process. So you have increased growth rates, and you have increased rates of infection, and increased cachexia or weight loss during treatment, and increased metastases, increased angiogenesis when there's systemic inflammation. The prostaglandins and leukotrienes that are inflammatory, those coming out of COX-2 and 5-LOX, drive, they act as growth messengers, and they drive the invasion, metastasis, and angiogenesis. So when we have an elevated inflammation, then we can get a direct benefit here from decreasing the inflammatory state. So there's definitely nutritional things and botanical things, dietary things that we do to try to lower the C-reactive protein. We look at those hand in hand, those two.
It strikes me as I'm listening to your very wonderful explanation that it was 1979 in my life. My colleague and I, Jay Johnson, at that time were both associated with the Bellevue Redmond Medical Facility. Dr. Lee Bowles was principal medical doctor there, and we had visits from people all over the world that were kind of in the field of nutritional medicine. And we had this visit from an oncologist from Australia. He described a very simple in-office procedure. It was almost like a pro time that was looking at basically how fast blood coagulated. And he had a certain range. And he actually had studied vitamin E and showed that vitamin E could have a positive effect on these cancer patients. And it had an impact on this test, the surrogate marker. So it's interesting how old things get learned better and better over time, and we get more precision. I give him a lot of credit because he was under a lot of criticism from his oncological colleagues in Australia at the time that this didn't seem reasonable. There was no mechanism of purported action, and 30 years can make a difference in our understanding.
Yeah. When your focus is just on the cancer cell, these types of markers of the environment or the terrain in the body don't make any sense to you. So it's one of those things, too, like 10 and 15 years ago when I talked to oncologists, they really thought I was out there in left field or out there in right field or not even on the map, you know, whereas now, and especially because I've been very careful to document scientifically where my approach is coming from. A client gets a report and they take that to their oncologist. They have 140 pages. It's very well referenced, and some 300 to 500 scientific references all from the mainstream literature. So it can be very eye-opening. On the inflammation side of this, there's a study that just stands out so much for me, and it really, if you haven't thought about how the environment in the body might be influencing the course of disease for a cancer patient, this study is just such an eye-opening one. It's Donald McMillan. It was published in Nutrition Cancer 2001, and it's a study of 772 cancer patients, predominantly breast, gastrointestinal, and lung cancers, where in the beginning of the study, he measured the C-reactive protein. There's no intervention, and he waits about 3 years, 1,000 days, and looks at survival based on the C-reactive protein. And what he found is that using a cutoff of 1.0, those patients who had low C-reactive protein, 40% of them were still alive at the 1,000-day mark. And those patients whose C-reactive protein was elevated above that level, none of them had survived that long. And this C-reactive protein correlation was stronger than stage of disease, extent of disease, and many of the other factors. So sort of saying, you know, here we are thinking about our cancer patients in terms of do you have stage 2 disease or do you have stage 4 disease, And it was actually a better indicator of overall survival whether or not they had inflammation. I really spent quite a bit of time thinking about that and thinking this might explain in part why sometimes you have a person with stage 2 disease whose disease is very, very aggressive and doesn't survive as long as one of those outliers with stage 4 who becomes a long-term survivor. Maybe it has more to do with the environment than the characteristics we are currently using to assess whether or not this cancer will behave aggressively.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. So let's move next on this list to hormones, because that is a big topic, obviously, with a lot of different molecules under the title hormones. So are there some that you find are more problematic or more of importance in your looking at those that stand up for clinical evaluation?
Yeah, I'll test on just two here, that being cortisol and estrogen. We're very interested in normal pattern of cortisol regulation throughout the day, looking at that Siegel and Stepton study out of Stanford where they showed, and this is sort of follow-up to their breast cancer study that's so well known, where they're looking at that pattern of normal cortisol secretion throughout the day and finding that dysregulation in that cortisol rhythm was associated with poor survival in breast cancer. And we certainly see that in our clients. I think that's probably mediated by many different events in the body. Cortisol, of course, increasing blood sugar and blood sugar dysregulation being, we find in our clinic, a very important factor. So there's the cortisol blood sugar issue. There's probably also elevated cortisol immune suppression going on. Although I haven't touched on it with you, there's also a relationship when adrenal function is low, it can drive copper up. The adrenals are needed to stimulate the synthesis of ceruloplasmin, and a copper-binding protein. Copper is a cofactor for many of the angiogenic enzymes like the VEGF and basic fibroblastic growth factor and HIF-1. So that when copper is low, it can slow the process of angiogenesis. So when you have elevated cortisol or cortisol dysregulation, hypoadrenia, then what you see is copper is elevated and it favors angiogenesis. High glycemic response, metabolic syndrome, also favors angiogenic response. So we're very interested in cortisol because of that. We do a lot of adaptogens and counseling about reducing stress to normalize that. So that's one area where hormones are of great interest to us. Another is in the estrogens, and there's the straightforward, are you looking at estrogen, say, in an ER-positive breast cancer or another type of cancer where estrogen drives it, such as some types of brain tumors, many types of head and neck cancers, and many of the other gynecologic or reproductive cancers. So that's an issue. But for us, where we're really focused about the estrogens is, again, back to angiogenesis. Estrogen drives copper up. So often when we have elevated copper, and we work very hard to decrease the copper as an anti-angiogenic strategy. So when you're looking at your free copper, so you've measured a serum copper and a ceruloplasmin, you need both of those numbers to get a sense of the free copper, what will diffuse into the tissues and act on angiogenesis. So you're using a simple formula where you take your ceruloplasmin and multiply that by 3 and subtract it from your serum copper to get a free or unbound copper. When you're looking at that, if your serum copper is elevated above 130, you are probably looking at somebody with the estrogen dominant situation. You're not going to be able to address the copper without addressing the hormone balance. On the other hand, if the ceruloplasmin is suppressed, especially below 22, you're probably looking at hypoadrenia and you're going to need to nourish the adrenals and use some adaptogens in order to successfully get the copper down in your anti-angiogenic strategy. So in terms of hormones, those are two that are standout. Sometimes we look at others, but those are probably the two most predominant places that we're looking.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. And as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of reflecting back. Years ago, this was probably the early 80s, I did a series of grand rounds at the University of Arkansas School of Medicine, and I met a professor there by the name of John Sorensen. If you do a PubMed on his name, he published a lot on copper, and particularly as it related to both vascular disease risk and to cancer. He was one of the first people that I had ever heard talk about molybdenum's antagonism of copper, and that he was actually studying molybdenum salts in animal tumor models, showing that you could prevent angiogenesis. And I know that there's some work on molybdenum that's occurred since then. So
yeah, that's George Brewer's work out of University of Michigan. And he has now 3 or 4 preclinical trials, pilot trials in cancer patients where they've used the off-label drug. It's a drug developed for Wilson's disease, tetrathiomolybdate. They've used that quite successfully in cancer patients to drive the copper levels down.
Yeah, so amazingly how these things all interconnect when you start looking at a broader picture. So let's move. This is a good segue. Obviously, you're talking about insulin and its influence on cortisol. So that leads us to hyperinsulinemic syndrome, which we call, I guess, metabolic syndrome. So tell us a little bit about how you look at that, how you assess that, and then maybe what your thoughts are about the appropriate food plan or diet plan for patients in that situation.
Yeah, and this is one of those ones where going all the way back to Warburg, perhaps, where there's the first acknowledgement that cancer cells are sugar feeders, and there's been such a controversy about that in the literature, and certainly the oncologists have a lot of resistance to that. And so moving forward, is it really the sugar itself that's the problem? I don't think that it is. I think what we're looking at here is that we get this metabolic syndrome where we have increase in the insulin and insulin resistance at the same time, and that sort of drives a huge cascade of events, which, for example, insulin resistance is then going to increase the secretion and production of insulin-like growth factors and decrease their binding proteins. So you have more active insulin-like growth factor that acts as an anti-apoptosis cascade. And then you have the adipocytes and the different hormones that they make, and that is increasing angiogenesis. And then you have the insulin increasing the activity and signaling of aromatase, so you get more free estrogen. And it's like this huge cascade of events that can impact the cancer in many different ways. When you look at the literature, you see for breast cancer patients, colon cancer, many other cancers, those who have signs, symptoms of metabolic syndrome have greater risk of recurrence, have greater rates of metastases, have significantly shorter survival. There's also some research showing post-op complications in colon cancer patients are much higher in those with metabolic syndrome. Patients undergoing bone marrow transplant have greater risk of infection. There's several different ways that this can impact the cancer process. So we screen for metabolic syndrome. We don't use a fasting glucose. We really look at the glycated hemoglobin A1C so that you're not getting a single snapshot of where the sugar is with the glucose. You're looking sort of more over a 2 to 3 months process. And then we're also looking at waist circumference, for example, and HDL cholesterol levels and just the whole kit and caboodle. So in terms of that, once we see that a client has, and I want to remember to say, I think it's really important. We have this, most of us who work, I think, in the integrative medicine field have this knowledge of metabolic syndrome. You're looking for waist adiposity, and you want to remember that cancer patients in chemotherapy and radiation undergo sarcopenia. They lose muscle mass, so that the number on the scale when they step on may be the same, and they may still fit into their clothes, and they may still look, quote, fit or have a lean body weight, but they may be metabolically obese as a result of having lost that muscle mass. So you want to remember to screen not only those with extra waist circumference, but you want to look at these markers if a person's been in treatment, because certainly they have metabolic syndrome even though they don't necessarily look apple-shaped, so to speak. And then in terms of the diet, I mean, this is just huge. I think a lot of people have approached the diet about what diet should we give a cancer patient, oh, based on politics and dogma and all different kinds of ideas instead of, I grew up a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian for a very long time. I was very wedded to that idea. But when I started having the idea that my clients with cancer needed to have a diet that lowered inflammation, was not high in copper, and did not raise the blood sugar, I really began to look very differently about what I should be suggesting for diet. And instead of coming from, this is the diet that everybody says is the right diet for cancer patients, I end up individually tailoring diet for each person based on how can we get their blood sugar down and their C-reactive protein down. So I often find when I have clients who come in who've been on a vegan and often but not always a vegetarian diet that they're having a lot of difficulty regulating their blood sugar on that diet. In particularly the vegan approach, we also find that it greatly elevates the copper, predominantly because the best food sources of zinc are meat foods, so that we end up doing a very low refined carbohydrate, very low carbohydrate, almost no starchy carbohydrates. We limit that very strongly so that the client is getting their carbohydrates predominantly from vegetables and legumes that are low glycemic, and letting them eat, yes, meat as long as it's organic and pastured or grass-fed, and poultry and eggs, which are often not included in those diets, we find that that is often the best way to regulate the blood sugar. you know, we look at other things. Do they have digestive incompetence? You know, if you have trouble with your digestion, you're not digesting your fats and proteins, then regardless of including them in the meals, you may only be getting your carbohydrates, and that causes a spike in your glycemic response after your meals. And we look at muscle mass. If they're sedentary, they need to be put on an exercise program with some weight training to build some muscle mass back. And we look at stress levels and cortisol and nutrient deficiencies, like chromium and zinc, magnesium, vitamin D, all those are involved in insulin resistance or in blood sugar regulation.
Beautiful response. So let's move to this concept of free radical oxidation, which often accompanies inflammatory conditions. And we have this whole big thing out there about antioxidants. And I know at the symposium, virtually every presenter spoke at least, or it touched partly in their discussion on this antioxidants conundrum. Do you have an opinion or thought about this antioxidant connection with oncogenesis?
Well, I could probably talk your ear off about it for several hours, but yeah, I definitely have some thoughts about that. And certainly looking at the literature, one thing that really stands out for me is the genetic stability. You know, when the oxidation is increasing, you get a lot of genetic instability. And so in terms of maximizing the treatment and preventing more aggressive behavior of cancers after, tumors after, you don't want that genetic instability. I think a big part of the, quote, controversy has sort of been on focus on antioxidant supplements. And I grin when I say that because I think the antioxidant power of vitamin C or vitamin E or some supplement pales in comparison to a whole food. And if you're looking at those charts on the ORAC values, for example, where you see vitamin E comes in at 125 ORAC, and this is research out of Tufts, and then you look at any respectable fruit, take blueberries, and the ORAC value is 3,250. So it's like you're not really talking about antioxidants when you're talking about a single nutrient that you're taking as a supplement. And many of the oncologists who perhaps have not studied antioxidants, and they use that term as if it was an umbrella of, you know, one or two things and don't sort of understand the different types of free radicals. And here they are telling their patients not to have any antioxidants and not realizing that if the person goes out and eats a chocolate bar, they are getting antioxidants. It's something that we look at. We know that with the diet that we're recommending, and we're trying to get our clients to eat 8 to 10 bare minimum half-cup servings of fruits and vegetables every day, we can see a big change in oxidation when they are doing that.
That's a beautiful recommendation. So let's talk briefly about this vitamin D controversy, because there's this concept that 125-dihydroxy vitamin D is a secco hormone that has great effects on multiple gene expression patterns, and it overdrive can increase oncogenic potential, but then an underdrive can also increase oxidative potential, suggesting a parabola of optimal levels in tissues of 125, but we're measuring the 25, so people assume that if 25 is low, 125 must be low, but we have actually seen, and I'm sure you have as well, there are some cases where people's 25 are low, but their 125 is high, and the more 25 you give them, the more they convert it to 125. So do you have a thought about this whole conundrum of vitamin D?
Yeah, and that was sort of new for me, something I got as a gem out of the conference, because we were not measuring 125 often. When the 25-hydroxy was not going up, then we would come and look at the 125, and then we were limiting vitamin D supplements, and so we said, okay, that's where it's going, and we don't know how to stop it from going there. We set our range of optimum vitamin D for the 25-hydroxy between 60 and 80, and I ended up setting that range based on several different studies and my work with autoimmunity, which runs in my family. We were aware, having worked with some autoimmune clients, that when we get the vitamin D to 80, that works sort of as an immune suppressant. That works sort of to induce immune tolerance. So when that works so well, my thinking was, well, I probably don't want to drive the blood level of 25-hydroxy over 80, or I may be suppressing immune response instead of benefiting it. So I think there's still quite a bit of basic research that needs to be done in vitamin D to answer some of these questions. But in our brain tumor group, certainly, there's a lovely study out of France by Paul Troyos in which they used high-dose vitamin D supplements in patients who had completed and failed all of their therapies, or more likely those therapies had failed them. So that, you know, the chemotherapies, radiation surgery, they had the maximum of those treatments and their tumors were still growing. And they had a fair response rate. I think it was 27% of the patients in that trial had a response, including several complete regressions. And there is 4-year, a 5-year, and now a 7-year survivor in that study, which is still ongoing. This is for glioblastoma multiforme, where it's 6 months is sort of a median survival, and if you make it to a year in the literature, that's considered quite good. So vitamin D having such a strong response as a differentiating agent in that study, we're still very enamored of using vitamin D for our clients. I think that there is a interplay between vitamin D, vitamin K, vitamin A, and perhaps vitamin C that has not yet been looked at. And we're having been wedded to the scientific approach of study this one thing individually, we really miss a lot in nutrition where there's such an important synergistic effect and interplay of many different nutrients together. So I'll be holding out until we get a clearer picture of what those interactions are and what to do.
Mm, very well said. So my last question has to do with this digestive incompetence that you referred to. And I know there's a big body of literature that's emerging right now about the gut microbiome and how the physiology of this highly diverse community of bugs we have in our gut influences our immune system and cellular function. And there is some work suggesting that certain supplements, pre and probiotic, might be useful in either pre or post-treatment cases in cancer. So what's your experience with pre and probiotics, if any, at this point?
Oh, we definitely use them for many reasons. You know, our clients are on all types of treatments that kill off the great majority of the flora in the intestines. And, you know, obviously those are so important in helping with immune competence. There's several other things that are important for that healthy eubiosis in the gut. Maybe key among those is when you have those healthy bacteria and you're eating a diet that's high in soluble fibers, your intestines become a butyrate manufacturing facility. And butyrate is histone deacetylase inhibitor. It's a differentiating agent. It's really important for cancer patients. So we really want to ensure that our clients have those healthy bacteria, at least for that reason, if not also to crowd out unfavorable bacteria, which would, for example, in a breast cancer patient, those bacteria would be using beta-glucuronidase enzyme to reassemble estrogens that had been broken down from the liver. So there's several different pathways in which that's really important to do. So it's definitely part of our protocols to do that.
Well, obviously, we've just touched the tip of the iceberg. You're just a dense treasure trove of extraordinarily useful information. But I guess I'd like to close in asking you a question to look out at the horizon for a moment. And with your experience that you're having both at the evolving frontier of the interface between science and patients and also with the changing way that patients respond to their own disease, what's your view of the future? How do you see things unfolding?
I'm really excited about where we are right now, and speaking at the symposium was really exciting to me to see many oncologists. I met many oncologists who were there, and I'm just thinking 10 years ago, that kind of friendly discussion between where we are with nutrition and complementary medicine and the integrative field and oncologists, that may not have been possible. So I feel like I've climbed a mountain, I'm standing at the peak, and I can see out over the field, and I'm actually very excited about where we are. I also think that this approach, I'm happy to be able to share this with people, and many practitioners keep all their secrets very carefully guarded. I don't feel that way. It's such a big field, and I'm happy to share my information. I think that one of the pearls of this particular approach is it really allows you to individualize the support for those cancer patients, whereas often your clients come to me and they've seen four or five practitioners, and they have the same little bag of, these are the 30 supplements that this practitioner gives to every cancer patient, and how do I know which ones are actually useful for me and which ones might be doing me harm? So this kind of exploration, using some testing to explore the terrain and then individualizing the protocol, I'm hoping that the entire field of oncology will move more in that direction, not only the integrative nutrition holistic approach being individualized, but also I'm seeing with a lot of the mainstream and conventional treatments that we're moving in the direction of individualizing cancer treatments. I think we're just at the beginning of that, and that's what we'll begin to see over the next 5 years. I'm excited about it.
Well, I think you're both a very articulate spokesperson for this evolution and also obviously a dedicated clinician professional really assisting people at times that are very challenging in their individual and their family lives. So I applaud you. It's very courageous of you. For our listeners, if you want to be reached, I presume it's through your group, Nutritional Solutions Consulting Group.
Nutritional Solutions, that's right.
Which is at nutritionalsolutions@comcast.net. Is that
it? That's correct. Yeah.
So we'll put that on the summary card again, nutritionalsolutions@comcast.net, people who want to contact you by email. So Dr. Wallace, thank you so much for spending the time with us. And again, I am so in admiration for what you're doing, and it's a big job. And as they say, you need big people to do big jobs, and obviously you're one of them. So thank you
so
much.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Wish you the very best.
So what is the ultimate objective of this month's Functional Medicine Update? I hope it became very clear to you hearing the eloquent and very well-framed conversation by Dr. Wallace of how she approaches cancer in her consultations, that there is something here in the functional medicine area that really deserves much more attention, that deserves much more focus to try to improve outcome and to reduce unnecessary burden of disease and prolong life, if not prevent the disease to begin with. And I think that this is a very, very exciting part of the functional medicine story. When we started down this road some 20-plus years ago, little did we know where the journey might take us. And I think it was my belief probably at the onset of functional medicine model that we wouldn't have much to say to oncology. But because we're all connected by this same web of physiology that connects cancer together with heart disease, with arthritis, with dementia, the functional medicine matrix and that method of thinking provides an insight that can be applied to virtually every state of pathophysiology. So I hope there are some tools and news to use out of this extraordinary discussion with Dr. Wallace.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form other than for personal use is prohibited.